Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to those who are here the first time, and hello over there to folks at the practice house. This is the third installment of the series on a poem that we chant sometimes, and it's in your chant book on page 10. It's called The Song of the Jewel Near Samadhi, and it's by 9th century Chinese Zen master Dongshan, who said to be the founder of our particular stream of Zen in China. Don't worry if you missed the previous sessions. This is not an easy text, so each time we enter it, you just take one phrase that resonates for you, that is good enough, and come back to it many times. And the earlier two talks are I believe posted on the website if you want to go back. As I said, it's not an easily accessible text, but with a little decoding, we can begin to enter Dongshan's world, even though it's a very long time before our own. And to see that maybe his world is not so different from ours, more than a millennium later. Just to review a little bit, the jewel mirror in the title represents our Buddha nature, represents our nature unbounded by conditioning, our nature unobscured by greed, hatred, and delusion, who are traditionally called the three poisons. So our mind unclouded, uncontaminated by greed, hatred, and delusion. That's the jewel mirror, and that's the state of samadhi, that state of clear mind. When we can see unclouded with our dharma eye, then we see Buddha nature all around us, in everyone we see, in everything we see, all beings sentient and insentient as our own reflection. So that's this image of the jewel mirror. And in the poem, Dongshan uses a lot of figurative language, different metaphors in various ways to talk about what in Buddhist thought are called the two truths. The truth of the absolute, or the truth of unity, of everything interconnected, undifferentiated, which is often referred to as darkness, because in the dark you can't see differences, right? And then the other truth, which is actually not, which is simultaneously true, is the realm of the particular, the relative, the everyday, and often referred to as the light, because in the light we can see differences. And yet those two realms are not separate. They coexist. In the darkness, all the different things are still there, right? And in the light, everything is still ultimately connected. There's another chant that we more often chant called harmony of difference and equality. So that's referring to those same two truths in harmony. And in that chant, it says, right in light, there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. Right in darkness, there is light, but don't see it as light. You've probably all seen the Taoist yin-yang symbol with the dark on the one side with a little white dot and the white on the other side with a little black dot. That's representing the same principle. And there's a strong Taoist influence in both these poems. So Dongshan's message in this poem is that we we can see this reality in Sanskrit called tatata, and in English, thusness or suchness, everything just as it is in this moment, fully unifying both those truths, the particular and the unified. And we can see deeply into this reality by sitting in Zazen. We practice sitting and standing, walking in each moment of our lives, being present to each moment of thusness. And the message in the poem is, in that awakening, in that realization, we are free from suffering because we're not pushing and pulling against what is right in this moment. Earlier, we seeing the line. Yeah, this often in the text, it, thusness, just this moment is referred to as it. So you'll remember turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire. Can't turn away, we also can't touch, it's beyond. It is bright just at midnight. It doesn't appear at dawn. It acts as a guide for beings. Its use removes all pains. So when we actually enter into this momentary thusness fully, suffering drops away. So last week, we read the core section of this poem where Dongshan describes his sort of template for practicing and realizing this jewel mirror samadhi as the five ranks or five positions. And that's a really difficult section, so I'm not going to review it. And we're going to come back to this at some future time. This is Dongshan's five ranks, because he writes some beautiful verses to go with them that are really worth spending some time with. But also to recognize that five ranks does not mean a sequence where you achieve first one and then the other and then the other. Remember the image from last time where he said, use the image of the five flavored herb, the plant that contains all the flavors of sweet, salty, bitter, pungent, and sour in one. And I did a little more research than I did last week, and I found out that this plant, it's actually a shrub called the Schizandra, and it's the red berries that are said to have these five flavors. And it's a very old Chinese medicine plant. And the berries, there've actually been some substantial research, particularly in terms of liver disease, that they protect. There's an enzyme that they contain. Other things too. But so that's the five flavored herb. And that's the way these five ranks are described as well. That they're different modes or phases of our practice. But we'll come back to them at another time. Let's pick up where we left off, which is going to be on page 11. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10th line. Okay, you can find that. Communing with the source, travel the pathways, embrace the territory, and treasure the road. So I thought, what does this mean? It's all a little bit abstract. So I looked at the Chinese, which consists of two lines of four characters each. Tong zong tong tu, xie dai xie lu. It rhymes. And there's a rhythm that's completely lost in the English. If we were to try and do that in English, it would sound probably terrible. But if we use the same English word for the Chinese words that are repeated, we get a little bit of a sense of how this works. So the first line would be, penetrate the source, penetrate the path. This word, su, or tong, penetrate can mean reach or pass through or communicate or understand. So this penetrate the source, penetrate the path is, I think, saying what Dogen, who's the Japanese founder of our way of Zen, calls the oneness of realization practice. So awakening, what this basically expresses is that awakening is only realized through our continuous practice. It's not out there countless years or centuries or millennia ahead of us. It's manifested in our practice as we do it and must be continuously expressed through our practice. So penetrating the source would represent the perspective of the absolute one, of absolute oneness, and penetrating the path, perspective of the relative. So they're the same. They're simultaneous. We only can awaken to the unity of everything through living in this particular world and paying attention. And the second line has that same parallel structure. We could say embrace the territory, embrace the path. The territory would be our boundless interconnection with the whole world, unity, and the path would be the particular landscape. So again, these are just ways of describing this dual, or not even dual, simultaneous reality of oneness and difference, sameness and difference. And also the simultaneous nature of practice and awakening, practice and awakening. The next line, then, he says, respecting this is fortunate, do not neglect it. Which is a pretty straightforward translation of the line. But Sheng Yan, who's a 20th century Chinese Zen master, offers a little bit different reading. He translates that same line as, to be wrong is auspicious. Do not oppose it. Says that for the first character, which is respecting this is fortunate, he says, can also mean something wrong. In other words, delusion. So he says, give you that quote in a bit. That right in awakening is also delusion. The black within the white within the black. It's through our delusion that we awaken. And so we shouldn't oppose or reject it, but use it to open our Dharma mind. So when delusion arises, we notice it and we open it, we turn it. So he's over and over again, he's giving us this paradoxical nature of the dual mirror. Naturally real, the next line, naturally real yet inconceivable. It is not within the province of delusion or enlightenment. So thusness, this moment just as it is simply natural, and at the same time, it's awesome. It's beyond the duality of delusion and enlightenment. It's not a matter of striving after an enlightenment experience, or it's not a matter of vanquishing delusion. We just practice, we practice steadily, and we integrate the experience of the absolute with it, the expression in this world, just as our lives unfold. So next verse goes, with causal conditions, time and season, quiescently it shines bright. In its fineness, it fits into spacelessness. In its greatness, it is utterly beyond location. So throughout ever-changing conditions, this light of awareness shines bright, illuminating life just as it is, always changing, boundless in space and time, both more minute and more vast than we can perceive or comprehend. You might, some of you, be familiar with the passage from Dogen, from the Genjo Koan, which is his essay called Actualizing the Fundamental Point. It goes like this. When you sail out in a boat in the midst of an ocean where no land is in sight and view the four directions, the ocean looks circular. But the ocean is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. It is like a palace, it is like a jewel. It only looks circular as far as you can see at that time. All things are like this. Though there are many features in this dusty world and the world beyond conditions, you see and understand only what your eye of practice can reach. Right? We only see within the bounds of our physical perception and also our mental capacity. In order, he continues, in order to learn the nature of the myriad things, you must know that although they may look round or square, the other features of oceans and mountains are infinite in variety. Whole worlds are there, all around you, also directly beneath your feet or in a drop of water. Whole worlds are there that we don't even see. Who knew that there were whole worlds in a drop of water until someone invented a microscope? Who knew there were whole worlds out in galaxies until someone invented a telescope? Whole worlds that we don't even perceive. I love how this passage describes the limits of human perception. Whole worlds in the heart and mind of each person we meet that we don't know. The next line goes, a hair's breadth deviation will fail to accord with the proper attunement. So what that means is as soon as we hang on to some fixed view or some label, we're already distorted. We're already distorting our view. Already we're stuck in the past or anticipation of the future, or we're missing the full scope of that moment. The full being of that person that we just saw and labeled in some way. A hair's breadth deviation, and then we fall into dissatisfaction, suffering. because we want it to be otherwise. There's another great Chan or Zen poem that is even earlier than this one that Dongshan would certainly have known, called the Xin Xin Ming, or Verses of Faith and Mind. We've talked about that here. And it begins, "The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. When neither like nor dislike arises, all is clear and undisguised. Separate by the smallest amount, however, and you are as far from it as heaven is from earth." So again, that hair's breadth. I imagine every one of us has made that slippage. Hair's breadth, right? We're fine, and then suddenly we're not, right? Suddenly we're miserable. What happened? Or suddenly we're miserable and something shifts, opens our heart, and that whatever it was that was so awful seems to have vanished, dropped away. What happened? You really need a coffee right now. And the kind you like is just not available. Or someone else grabs that parking space that you just had your eye on. Those are the little ones. Or it could be something really momentous. Somebody else that got that job that you had your heart set on. Or your beloved announces they don't want to be with you anymore. Or a diagnosis comes in for someone you love, for yourself. And you're plunged from the heavenly realm into a hell realm, or a hungry ghost realm. It's amazing how fast it can happen, right? Fast. Something will jolt us out of our habitual rut, and suddenly the world will appear different. The good news is that with our steady practice, we can stabilize that reactivity, and we can be less blown about by those changes, by the what are called the eight worldly winds: pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. We're always trying to get one and avoid the other, right? Who wants blame? We'd rather have the recognition. Pleasure and pain, loss and gain. We can be a little bit less blown about. So next verse, we're about to pass the halfway point down that page now. And Dongshan says, "Now there are sudden and gradual in which teachings and approaches arise. Once basic approaches are distinguished, then there are guiding rules. But even though the basis is reached and the approach comprehended, true eternity still flows." What he's talking about here are the often sort of stereotyped two approaches to Zen practice, the sudden and the gradual. Is awakening sudden or is it gradual? In China, there were two whole schools that emphasized those two ways. One, a sudden breakthrough experience of a conditioned mind falling away. The other, more of a gradual polishing, like wiping the dust from the mirror. So Dongshan said that these basic approaches are developed and the methods may be skilled, but true eternity flows. It's not limited to one way or one doctrine. Such all these distinctions merge in the jewel mirror samadhi. How could awakening be anything but sudden in this moment? At the same time, boundlessly present. And how, at the same time, how could awakening be anything but gradual, maintained and refined and integrated over years of living in this world? It's not one or the other. In the next verse, Dongshan talks about different kinds of Zen students. He says, outwardly still, while inwardly moving like a tethered colt, a trapped rat. The ancient sages pitied them and bestowed upon them the teaching. So he's referring, did you ever feel like a trapped rat sitting in the, he's referring here to monks who might have very strong concentration, right? They're sitting there looking like really good meditators. Maybe even they're a little self-satisfied. But they've suppressed a lot. And there's really a tension there. They've suppressed their deluded, reactive mind, and maybe they really don't want to see that. Here's what Sheng Yan, the Chinese teacher I mentioned, says about this verse. He says, samadhi produces a calm and stable mind. Some wisdom may manifest. It enhances strong faith and practice, but it is not Zen. The mind is contained, delusions are tamed, but the potential for them to arise is still there. A dormant volcano may look beautiful and serene, but at any moment it may erupt. When samadhi power subsides, delusions will reemerge. So he's saying, you don't want to be a dormant volcano in your zazen. Have you ever found yourself sitting all rigid and tense, but inside your mind is in turmoil? Can you possibly sit still until the bell rings? Can that person sitting so still beside you tell what a mess you are inside? A terrified colt, a trapped rat, unable to move, but trembling inside, heart pounding. That's how we feel sometimes in our lives, not just in our zazen, but in our lives. When we can't fight or flee, we freeze. Isn't that how so many people go through life? Putting on a brave face or a cheery face, never letting on how vulnerable we really feel. Some go into fight mode easily when they feel threatened. Some tend to flee, run away, avoid, and some freeze like the tethered colt, trapped rat. And these are all responses that are necessary in our sort of in primal sort of life-threatening situations, right? But in daily life, not so much. They can really get in the way of fully living our lives. But as Dongshan said, the ancient sages took pity on us and taught us another way to be present with our own suffering, with our own reactivity. They taught us how to sit in this dignified posture, not with gritted teeth and rigid muscles, but with a sort of spacious, patient, non-judgmental awareness of our own moment-to-moment experience. Staying with whatever arises, seeing whatever arises as due to causes and conditions and subject to change. Then we can be a little less identified with the content that arises and less driven by it. So when we talk about this jewel mirror samadhi, it goes beyond a kind of temporary achievement of deep concentration. As Dongshan said, it's so minute, it can penetrate the finest cracks of our armored selves, and it's so vast, nothing is excluded. Nothing is excluded. The great 10th century Japanese woman poet Izumi Shikibu wrote a short poem, "Watching the moon at dawn, solitary, mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out." So that's jewel mirror samadhi, no, nothing left out. Next verse goes, according to their delusions, they call black as white. When erroneous imaginations cease, The acquiescent mind realizes itself. Want to conform to the ancient way? Please observe the sages of former times. So what he's saying, when we're caught in that delusion that our existence is substantial and separate, ours, we call black as white. We can't see that we exist within a great matrix of interconnectedness. But when we see in the jewel mirror, then, as I said, those three poisons of greed, aversion, and ignorance actually are transformed into medicine to heal ourselves and the world. When we let go of greed, when greed is released from self-clinging, it transforms into compassion and caring. An aversion released from self-clinging is transformed to something called discriminating wisdom. Discriminating wisdom means clear-seeing wisdom. And delusion transforms into clear-seeing equanimity. So each of those states of suffering has a transformed quality. And when our conditioned habits patterns drop away, that bright, clear light of awareness shines equally on all things, like the white egret in the moonlight in the beginning of the poem. This is the ancient way, the way of the sages of old. So I know this is not easy, this is difficult language, but I hope as we've come this far in reading the poem, that you begin to see how this jewel mirror samadhi actually relieves suffering. It's not just abstract, it's about our actual practice in this moment, a way of seeing. It's not something we can rationally think our way into, or if we do try, it will only take us so far. But I think some of these ancient words and images can help us kind of prime the pump, or perhaps gestate or the seeds of awakening, so that our mind will be ready to let go and open. We can open our Dharma eye, and it might be when we're in the Zafu, sitting here in the Zendo, but more likely it will take us by surprise, just when we're least expecting it. As Dogen says, the whole sky turns. Suddenly we see differently. Sometimes it's when we just get so frustrated or sick and tired of ourselves, something just lets loose, or something will come forward to us from the world to open that Dharma eye. And then we just continue our pilgrimage through life, maintaining our practice, nothing special. As the great Zen master Zhaozhou said, ordinary mind is the way. So we keep from one moment of just this to the next. So I want to invite you, as we usually do, to just take a few minutes to speak with each other. And I want to invite you to just